You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Unfortunately, this pandemic has become, in many respects, an equalizer. And I think coming out of this, I think there'll be a greater sensitivity to what low-income families have to deal with each and every day.
Hello and welcome to the Ezra Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. This episode is about a national crisis. Sort of about the one you think, coronavirus, but more about one that predates it. America has a child poverty rate that is unique among peer nations. About one in six children, nearly 12 million children total, lived in poverty before the pandemic hit. One in six, just sit and think about that. Of every six children in the country, one were in poverty. That's about one in three Black children. It's about the same for American Indian children, nearly one in four Hispanic children, and about one in 11 white children. It's a huge racial component here. This is a choice. It's a choice. Other countries impose different policies and they make different choices. And something that I think we're seeing over the course of the pandemic is one, a lot of middle income or even upper income families have been thrown into the same world of unstable, unreliable, or completely absent childcare that poor families are in all the time and have seen the way that is terrible for the children, have seen the way that makes it impossible for the adults to do work and to get ahead at work. If there's one silver lining coming out of this, I hope it is some sensitivity to this crisis. But the other thing is that it wouldn't even be that expensive to change. It wouldn't be that expensive to change. There is nothing in American political life where there is a bigger difference between our rhetoric and our policy action than on children. Every politician from both parties talks about how we need to have equal opportunity. Nobody thinks children are responsible for their own lot in life. And yet we allow this ongoing national stain and this horror in these children's lives to just go forward. It wouldn't be that expensive to fix. So as we are doing this series on how to remobilize the economy in partnership with the OMIDIAR Network, and you can check out more of it on Vox. It's called The Great Rebuild there. We're sort of looking at it through the mobilization and remobilization lens. And I'm interested here in how could we rebuild in a way that actually took seriously children's welfare? How could we rebuild an economy in the aftermath of COVID that was as good for children as we claim to be as a country? And my guest for it is somebody I've wanted to have her on forever. She is my congresswoman, which is very exciting because she is awesome. But Representative Barbara Lee from Oakland. She's an amazing history herself, but was also, among other things, a single mother raising two children trying to go through school. And so it's no accident that in Congress, Lee is one of the leaders on thinking about children, thinking about child care, thinking about child poverty. A couple years back, she got put into law the need for the National Academy of Sciences or a mandate for them to produce a huge report on how to halve child poverty over 10 years. And they did it. And you know what that report found? It is unbelievably achievable. Unbelievably achievable. So for more of the Great Rebuild series in partnership with the OMIDIAR Network, you can visit vox.com/the-great-rebuild. Get all the podcasts in this series. Coming in September, a special issue of our magazine, The Highlight. But for now, here is Representative Barbara Lee. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be with you.
It's such a pleasure here to have you. You're my local representative, so I feel like I'm having a real like a local politics experience.
Oh, that's great. Well, you know, it is the most progressive and enlightened congressional district in the country, the great 13th congressional district. So glad you're my constituent.
The fighting 13th. Let me jump into this. In 2015, you commissioned this big National Academies of Sciences report on child poverty. What led to you commissioning that report?
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, as a member of the Appropriations Committee, I do a lot of work on child poverty. And also, I've been trying to get for years and years and years our Democratic caucus to really talk about fighting for the poor, for low-income people, as well as for the middle class. So fortunately, Speaker Pelosi established a task force on poverty and opportunity. So this has just been part of the work that I've been doing over the years. And when you look at the poverty rates in America, and especially with Black and brown children, and when you look at the poverty rates just in my district, in California, in the Golden State of California, they're off the scale. And so we wanted to look at, have the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine to conduct a study on how to cut child poverty in half in the next 10 years. We should be able to eliminate it, but we could only get to cutting it in half. And so the highlights from the study are very important because it's a roadmap for legislative and funding priorities for the House of Representatives and some state and local measures that it addresses also.
So paint the picture for me before we get into the policy measures. What does child poverty look like in America? And not maybe just child poverty, but also just child policy. How do we differ from peer nations?
Okay, when you look at child poverty, it's already a shameful, it increased from 13.6% to 21%. But when you look at childhood poverty, and I'm gonna use California as an example, 28.6% of African-American children live below the poverty line. 26.3% of American Indian Native Americans live below the poverty line. 24.4% of AAPI children and 24.2% of Latinx children live below the poverty line. This is outrageous. In the entire country, you're looking at 31% of American Indian, Native Americans living below the poverty line, children, 29% of African American children, 23% of Latinx children, and 11% of AAPI children. Now, these are statistics from 2018, which shows that over 12 million children are living and were living in poverty. And of course, now because of COVID-19, the numbers are even worse.
And what are the numbers for non-Hispanic white children?
The numbers are higher. Okay, the percentages are lower. In terms of the numbers, I believe it's more like probably 8 to 10%, but I'd have to verify that also. But the numbers are still high across the board. But it's the percentages of poverty that the that we looked at in terms of the disproportionate rates of childhood poverty.
And one of the things that is always striking to me when looking at this is our rates of child poverty across the board are double or triple the rates of child poverty we see in most European countries. And we're richer than most of those countries on a per capita basis. So is the kind of child poverty we see in America, is that simply a policy choice we are making through inaction?
Policy choices, yes. But also, it's systemic. You have economic inequality that's just part of the DNA of America, as well as systemic racism. And so with white children, you know, you've got many, many low-income poor children living in many parts of the country, such as in West Virginia. And then you have percentages of Black and brown children whose families have to deal with systemic racism each and every day. And so when you look at when you look at the wage gap, you know, Black and brown families as opposed to white families, when you look at the wealth gap, when you look at the data around housing, when you look at the healthcare demographics, you can look across the board. You have social determinants of healthcare where children who live below the poverty line get sicker earlier. And so it's a vicious cycle. And so economic inequality and racial inequality, systemic racism, really contributes to the huge numbers of children living below the poverty line in America.
Well, what's the effect on a child of growing up in poverty?
Well, a child growing up in poverty, and I can tell you, first of all, you have healthcare issues. And I have to refer to myself. I lived on public assistance for about 4 years, raising two small children when I got a divorce and as a student in college. And it was really hard. I couldn't, first of all, afford childcare. So I had to take my children to class with me, you know, and they have to do their own homework. And so the stress alone with regard to what happens with children, going to school maybe with not enough food to eat. So we have to have school breakfast and lunch programs because so many children, that's their only meal. And so when you look at the healthcare, nutrition, when you look at substandard housing, when you look at many low-income people live in polluted areas where there's not clean water, clean air, toxic pollutant dump sites, toxins in the atmosphere. When you look at the entire life of a child whose family makes barely minimum wage, and then access to SNAP and Section 8 vouchers are difficult to come by because of this administration, you see this cycle of poverty where families have a difficult time, even those working two and three jobs, to move themselves out of poverty. And of course, the children with the school system, larger class sizes, fewer teachers. It's, I always almost want to say, a pandemic upon a pandemic as it relates to the poverty pandemic for children living in America.
One of the parts of the report that I found really striking was that it identified these two mechanisms through which growing up in poverty can affect children. The first one, which I think is intuitive to people, you just mentioned it a couple times, is investment, right? Not enough healthcare resources, sometimes not enough food, not a stimulating environment, not as much supportive childcare, and on and on. But the other one is stress, this wear and tear of environmental stressors, of fear, of instability, of being evicted, like you see in Matthew Desmond's book, that changes children's cognitive development. Can you talk a bit about that dimension of it?
Yeah, and you know, my background is clinical social work. So by profession, I'm a psychotherapist, and I really understand how that weighs, how stress weighs on children as a result of these social determinants. When you look at trauma, for example, many children who live in low-income communities, especially in Black and Brown communities, are traumatized by gun violence, constantly hitting the ground, hitting the floor, constantly trying to figure out how to move around so that they're not shot. When you look at the trauma around police misconduct, and I certainly and still have to talk to my grandchildren, my sons have to talk to our grandchildren, his children, about what to do in case a police officer encounters you and you need to protect yourself and know the appropriate behavior. Well, that's stressful and it's traumatizing. And so trauma leads to stress, which leads to acting out. I mean, some young people are having a very difficult time. You see the high rates of suicide with young, especially young African-American teenagers now, boys especially. When you look at the fact that young people in grammar school now have diabetes, and so if they don't have adequate health care, they don't have their insulin, they don't have their diabetic medication, which just compounds the problems that they have in terms of just living. And so you have the health impacts of poverty, and you also have the mental health trauma that is associated with life's the environmental factors, and it's a moral disgrace that we don't look out for our children and that we don't address the environmental factors and the social determinants of their lives, because you have to do that to make sure that children don't get stressed out or have breakdowns or end up getting shot or end up in juvenile hall or end up hanging out where the police might encounter them that could lead to some terrible outcomes. So let me tell you, in America, children living in this country, for the most part, if you're not white, middle income or upper income, you really have a hard time. You really have a hard time. And then you have to deal with living in close quarters because the cost of living in some communities and cost of housing is so high. I mean, no child should have to live like this. And so that's why we want to make sure we follow some of the recommendations from this report so that we can start addressing this in a holistic and in an intersectional manner, which we have to do if we're going to lift children out of poverty.
And just to add one thing to that before we get into some of those solutions, just one of the studies in this I found most striking was in PLOS-1, which is a scientific journal called Family Poverty Affects the Rate of Human Infant Brain Growth. And you can actually measure in gray matter cells, which is a particular cell in children's brains, is very important for information processing and behavior regulation. When you look at kids in low, medium, and high socioeconomic status families, their gray matter starts the same and changes over time because what you're living under forces your brain to develop in different ways. I mean, we are literally pushing children's brains into different directions when you make them fight for survival and fear for what tomorrow will bring. It's unbelievably heartbreaking.
It is, because these physiological changes really determine a child's future. And if this occurs, what happens to you when you grow up? What happens to you in terms of quality of life? What kind of job are you going to be able to get? What kind of skill set will you have? What kind of higher education or vocational training will benefit you to make a decent wage and standard of living? So yeah, it is immoral. It is quite disgraceful.
It always strikes me as making such a hash of ideas of personal responsibility and just desserts, because the things that when somebody is 17 or 18 or 23, we're very happy to blame them for, right? Did you get good grades? You know, did you drop out of school? What, you know, did you come in every day at the right time to that job? Like, I've done a bunch of those things, but if I had my brain develop in a different way because I grew up in a house with a bunch of lead in it, I very well may not have. And the idea that like I should get a prize because my environment was so conducive to healthy growth and other people should be punished for growing up in another one, it always strikes me as very strange. Like in American politics, you hear it all the time in Congress among your colleagues. You'll always hear, especially Republicans, say, I don't believe in equality of outcomes. I believe in equality of opportunity. But actually making equality of opportunity real is so unbelievably hard and so far from where we are that it becomes cynical.
Yeah, look at the young people in Flint. I mean, just an example. There's so many communities mm-hmm. around the country that have poison in their water, lead in their schools and their homes. It's a disgrace. It is really a health hazard, and it's deadly. You know, kids should not have to live under these circumstances, not able to get clean water or, you know, take a bath, have to use bottled water or have to boil their water. Come on, what kind of life is that in America, the wealthiest and most powerful country in the world? It's shameful, it's disgraceful, and everyone who has a conscience should stand up and say, no more, we're going to deal with child poverty in a comprehensive way so that we can begin to turn this around.
Support for the Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this podcast comes from Greenlight. If your parents wrote you a blank check when you were 10 years old, what's the one thing you would have bought? I know for me, it would have been Podcast Futures. Or maybe that yellow Ford Ranger pickup truck that the lifeguards on Baywatch used to drive on the beach. That looked like a lot of fun. I don't know why I needed it. Didn't have the money anyway. But I wanted one. Would that have been a smart, long-term financial decision? Probably not. I would have learned that lesson the hard way. But what the Greenlight card wants to do is help your kids learn those vital financial lessons the easy way. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. A colleague of mine here at Vox uses the Greenlight card with his two boys, and he loves it. You can sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/grayarea. That's greenlight.com/grayarea to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/grayarea.
What would our social policy look like if we truly invested in kids? Like, what is the future we want to get all the way to here?
Our policy, first of all, I think would say that every family should be guaranteed a universal income. We should have a floor. No one should have to live below the poverty line. And we certainly have enough resources in this country to guarantee universal income. Second, we should have universal preschool for every child. We should make it affordable or free. Three, we should make sure that food security is what it should be in terms of either increasing SNAP benefits or making some type of a strategy that incorporates addressing food deserts where families can't get to the grocery stores, and just make sure that food is easily accessible, healthy and nutritious food. Next, we have to have, and I support Medicare for All, universal affordable health care. I think single payer would be a heck of a lot more comprehensive in terms of addressing health care for children. Child care workers, we need to make sure that our child care workers are trained and that they have benefits and are unionized. And especially during this pandemic, we have to make sure that they have access to the help needs that they have. And so I think we know how to do this. Tax credits, the child care tax credit, it's a good idea to give low-income families the same access to care without the financial burden. So we know how to do this, but we have to start with, I think, economic equality. And we have to dismantle systemic racism, because you see the disproportionate rates of Black and brown children living below the poverty line. And that's where we should start, valuing the dignity of all human beings and setting up policies that provide for a basic standard of living, which we do not do in this country.
One of the things that's striking to me about that list is that if that sounds ambitious to you and you're listening, it's worth noting that we already do a huge amount of that for seniors. There's a universal healthcare program. There is in Social Security something that looks a lot like a universal basic income for seniors. The people who work with seniors, particularly through Medicare, are very, very highly trained. We have this much more social democratic system for seniors, which we should, but we somehow have not extended almost any of that to children. Or for that matter, often to parents of children. Medicaid for a while, or Medicaid has done work with particularly single mothers and young families, but even making that more universal is recent and incomplete. Why do you think it is that there's been so much more success extending this kind of policy to America's elderly and not to American children, where that investment is both cheaper and has a lot longer in somebody's life to shape them and to shape their successes?
Well, yes, and I think we need to do more for seniors, because we still haven't totally stepped up to what we need to do in the twilight of one's life. And I think our seniors deserve a heck of a lot more. But we do have Medicare and Social Security, but even those programs are in jeopardy. And again, it's the political leadership, i.e. now Donald Trump, that really are trying to make it even more difficult for seniors. And so I think we have to talk about values, the values of valuing human life and human dignity, regardless of how old you are. And children, the Children's Defense Fund and other organizations have been very active lobbyists for children, but I don't see the type of money being put into lobbying for legislation that directly would lift children out of poverty that I have seen over the years when it came to our senior citizens. And thank goodness they have an active lobby in Washington, D.C. through AARP and other senior groups. But again, we need to value human dignity and human life. And, you know, some of these right-wing Republicans are so anti-choice. They want to make sure that women don't have the full range of reproductive choices that include access to abortion care. But yet they won't vote to take care of our young people once they're born. So it's a real political struggle. It's a political problem. But I think it all has to do with valuing human life and valuing human dignity. And for some reason, you know, there's some of those who just don't think children deserve what they deserve at the beginning of their lives so that they can move forward and be the productive human beings and live healthy lives and take care of themselves and their families and enjoy being an American and living in this country. And so many are denied that opportunity.
So that's the big picture vision. Tell me what the report recommended that would cut child poverty in half in 10 years.
First of all, let me just say how much the report showed us that it costs between $800 million to $1.1 trillion, okay, due to an increase in crime, diminished health outcomes, and lower earnings. Now, imagine if we cut poverty in half, that $800 to $1 trillion we could do. Also, we should increase the earned income tax credit so that more families can get a refund. We recommend a 40% increase because so many families need that to pay their bills for their utilities, and it's a decent refund that you get, a couple of thousand dollars. Same with the low-income child tax credit. It gives low-income families access to care without the financial burden because you get this tax credit with very minimal income. And we've got to mitigate the wage gap as it relates to communities of color and raise the minimum wage to a living wage. Also, there's several bills like right now that we're working on, the rental eviction moratorium, for example. In the midst of COVID-19, we've got to have a ban, and this wasn't in the report, but we've got to have a ban on evictions. And that would, of course, end after 6 months after the declaration, the emergency declaration has ended. But more children are falling into poverty now. And so we need to make sure that we address housing, because if we don't, more and more children will fall into poverty. Also, we, of course, invest in, and we want more investment in food stamps, public assistance, safety net, because most families don't want to rely on public assistance. But when they have difficulties just surviving, then we should say, yes, our government, which is what happened when I needed my government's help, the taxpayer support, is going to be there for you. And so we need to make sure that we increase access. And the report mentioned SNAP benefits and, of course, health care for our children. And, you know, again, it's an economic issue, and this is a racial issue. Universal preschool, I mentioned earlier. And I think Vice President Biden has a $775 billion plan to mobilize the economy around caregiving, which is a lot of caregiving for our children. Head Start, you know, my former district director was a graduate of Head Start. Well, every year the Republicans try to cut it, but we, of course, as Democrats, increase it because the Head Start program has worked. So report, you know, indicates that we should increase resources for Head Start and Section 8 vouchers. And again, boosting the minimum wage, I think it was like $10.25, $15 an hour, it should be minimum. I think $10.25 is still too low. But even a boost from, you know, where it is now to 10.25 is something, but it's not significant enough, again, personally, to think that families can lift themselves out of poverty and their children out of poverty. So we've got to get to the $15 minimum wage, but then we have to move toward a living wage. And a living wage in some areas is $30, $40 an hour. You know, so we have to look at poverty, how we reevaluate the formula for determining the poverty rates and the indices as it relates to poverty. So the report goes into quite a few recommendations, but I think what we did was we went around the country. We went to Texas, we visited Wisconsin and other communities to look at some of the best practices and some of the programs that were working. I remember one, and you have to address the formerly incarcerated individuals and families, because there's currently a restriction on Pell Grants and SNAP eligibility for formerly incarcerated returning citizens. And we need to lift those bans so that they too can take care of their families as they move back in after they've done their time. And we did talk to many people who did receive a second chance through a barbershop that we went to in Wisconsin, and how they were lifting themselves out of poverty into the middle class by learning how to become barbers and having a barbershop, which was organized by former inmates. So there are many, many legs to this, but we've got to have childcare. And we've got to have income. We've got to address economic inequality. And I think the report indicates that those are the best ways to do that. And the child tax credit and the increase in the EITC.
Yeah. And to just draw two things you were saying there, you'd mentioned that they're finding that child poverty costs America about $800 billion to $1.1 trillion every year in increased crime, worsened health, lower earnings. And that's certainly an underestimate given what they can and can't measure. And none of these plans cost $800 billion to $1.1 trillion a year. So like every researcher will tell you investing in children is a bargain. But one of the things the report does talk about, and one of the impediments to doing this kind of social policy well in America, has been in a very racialized way. Congress has tended to make these programs really onerous. They put work requirements on them. They make them humiliating to apply for. And something the report really emphasizes is that these should be unconditional transfers, that you want this money to reach the adults so it reaches the children. And if you make it hard for the adults to get it, the children are the ones who suffer. So could you talk a bit about that, about the way in which politically here, the punitive way we treat and judge and racialized way we treat and judge adults in American social policy has worsened child poverty?
Well, when you put work requirements on an adult as it relates to eligibility, just as an example for SNAP benefits, first of all, 60%, I believe it's 60% of people who are eligible for SNAP benefits are working, first of all. Secondly, the economy dictates what jobs and what industries are available. And we have not invested in job training. And many, many people, especially Black and Brown people, have not found jobs under this Trump administration. And so if you can't find a job, if you're doing everything you can do, and most people who are eligible for these benefits are looking for a job. And so it's not, you know, what this administration paints is these are lazy people. These are people who want to work. And for whatever reason, they haven't been able to get a good paying job. And so they should be eligible to be able to take care of their family and not have these onerous work requirements placed on them. Eligibility requirements, and again, going back to the formerly incarcerated individuals, these people get out of prison with, what, $200, and yet they're not eligible to go back to school with Pell Grants or SNAP benefits. And it's extremely onerous. And so what happens is children are the ultimate ones in a family who get hurt the most because they won't have enough to eat because their parents have been required to do what may or may not be possible. And that's, you know, meet the eligibility requirements for work. And certainly, and currently in this pandemic, when so many people have been laid off and so many jobs have gone away, and we've done this in our legislation in the Appropriations Committee, to get rid of these work requirements, because it says to people that we don't believe you deserve to eat and to sleep and to live a decent life. That, and it's very, and again, it's very dehumanizing also to for people to have to scrape like this in America. And so these requirements need to go, if you ask me.
One of the policies report emphasizes that people may not be as familiar with is a child allowance, which is almost a good, like the simplest way to put it is a universal basic income for kids. And they say that a $2,700 a year child allowance would single-handedly cut child poverty by a third. Like, that's a big effect. And it's something that a lot of European countries have. Canada has a child allowance. Could you talk a bit about that as a policy option?
Yeah, and it's a good policy option because if you have a child allowance of $2,700 a year, and then if you have basic guaranteed income, and this is not a quote socialist concept, but this is a guaranteed paycheck, you know, when you're unemployed, with combined with the child allowance, then you can maybe come from underwater and move forward. But as long as you're spinning your wheels, it's not going to work. And when you have a child allowance such as this, then you have the resources to help you pay for childcare or help you pay some of your utility bills, or you can buy more food. I mean, just again, this is just the basics. The $2,700 is not all that much. But again, you find that the cost benefit analysis of that is you would end up reducing the amount of taxpayer dollars that go for the social safety net. So it makes a heck of a lot of sense for me. And I think we're going to have to get to that point in this country. I really believe that. And, you know, it's going to be a political battle because, they're going to call us all kinds of names. But who cares? We've got to take care of our children and our families.
One of the things that this is all going to come in context of in a new administration is this economy that has been functionally bombed out by COVID-19. So how would a big investment of kids help get adults back to work? Is this something that could help get the economy moving again, or is this something that is separate from that project?
No, it would help get the economy going again, because first of all, you have the health and safety of our children and adults at risk, and you have to take that into consideration, and also the economic impacts. And so, for instance, childcare workers, essential workers especially, who are required to go to work, unfortunately, sometimes without the protective equipment that they need. First of all, they need help in caring for their children, but yet their children could be exposed if the government, quite frankly, doesn't make sure that those health protocols at the childcare centers have the type of health protocols and are equipped to make sure the children stay healthy. So we have to invest in childcare centers and in the individuals who own these childcare centers, because they're going under. And so you have a group of essential workers who need childcare. Childcare centers are going under because they don't have the children, and yet we can't help the childcare centers become compliant so that the parents can safely leave their children and that the childcare operators can safely take care of the children. So it just doesn't make any sense what's taking place. And so you end up with even a deeper dive into poverty, because so many more children now are falling into the ranks of the poor because their parents have been impacted by the pandemic.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc. Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
One of the things that I think coronavirus has done, although I'm not sure it's always stated this way, is give a lot of people with more wealth and resources an idea of what it is like to be a working parent without wealth and resources, what it's like to try to juggle not having childcare for your kids, but having a job, not having a reliable way to make sure those two things are separated, not have reliable care because you can't always get it, not be able to lean on family who maybe you already had. And I wonder if there's not some kind of solidarity that could come out of this, because I think a lot of people are seeing that when you don't have the ability to make sure your children are cared for, your ability to work, your ability to move ahead at work, your ability to be productive, all those things that we end up patting ourselves on the back for doing as we, you know, if we're lucky enough to be moving up in the economy, like that really depends on childcare. And the fact that so many people do not have the capacity to rely on that, that's happened to almost everybody during the pandemic. But it often strikes me that what's happening to so many during the pandemic is simply what normal life is like for a lot of people outside the pandemic.
Unfortunately, this pandemic has become, in many respects, like you summarized it, an equalizer. And I think coming out of this, I think there'll be a greater sensitivity to what low-income families have to deal with each and every day. And I think that this gives us an opportunity to form broader political coalitions. And, you know, talk about suburban white housewives or suburban white mothers or single moms who haven't had to deal with this because they've had access to opportunity and good paying jobs. Well, now, you know, we need to work with them to make sure they understand this is how it is for us all of the time. And I think that sensitivity is there. But also added to that, though, so many kids who are not in school for the right reasons don't have access to broadband. And a lot of, you know, people who had jobs, if they did not lose their jobs, they've got access to broadband and can telecommute. And so a lot of people are beginning to see the disparities in as it relates to access to technology with low-income children, because there is no way, if you don't have access to broadband, that you can do online classes. And there is no way, if you don't have access to broadband, that you can keep a job that requires this. And so, yeah, I think it gives us, unfortunately, it's taken so much death and pain to help people understand the condition of others. And I think does present an opportunity to build a stronger coalition around eliminating childhood poverty.
And should this also be a reminder in a way that investing in kids is also investing in adults, that taking care of children is also taking care of adults? I think that's a part of this conversation that often gets lost.
Sure, because you invest in kids, you're helping parents make sure that they're able to go to work without a lot of worry. They're able to come home and their children have been in school and they've learned something, and they, yes, will need help with their homework, but it won't be as difficult because they've had a good day at school. And you don't have to worry about your child being safe. You don't have to, again, going back to gun violence, you know, making sure the guns are taken off the streets. You don't have to worry about, you know, kids being shot at school if we had better gun control laws. And so, yeah, taking care of children relieves a lot of the stress and strain on parents. And again, referring to my personal experience, it was difficult as can be trying to figure out how I could study, go to classes. I was on work study, active as a community worker with the Black Panther Party, and take care of my children, and all of that going on at one time. And had I had money, you know, I could have had more childcare where it would have relieved me from some of the pressure. But we may do, and they're phenomenal young men. But so many, especially so many single moms, don't have that network and that support system in place to be able to juggle. And it creates more stress and more trauma, really, for the family.
We have a tendency in American politics to lionize stories like yours, to say, well, look, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, she came up through all that. So it's pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I remember President George W. Bush talking about somebody who was working, I think it was three jobs, and saying, oh, what a great American story. What do we miss when we do that? If you were able to come through that and become a member of Congress, why is any action here needed at all?
No way. First of all, nobody should have to go through what I went through. And my whole life has been dedicated to fighting to remove the barriers so people don't have to go through what I went through. It's hell. And you do not want your friends and your family members and your country to go through this. And so it's by the grace of God, period, that I was able to make it. And it took a lot of stuff and a lot of trauma associated with it. And so there's no way you can bully yourself up by your bootstraps in this country if you don't have any boots. And this country has got to strengthen its safety net and a foundation so that women and men can move forward. Right now, there are too many barriers, and I know that. And so you can't tell me that women especially don't try to break through these barriers, but it's systemic. The barriers are structural, they're systemic. And again, as I look back, I don't even know how I did it. And I have no clue. And all I know is my whole life is about trying to make sure that others don't have to go through what I went through.
We're talking a couple of days after Vice President Biden named Senator Kamala Harris to be his vice president. You were an early endorser of Senator Harris. She's from Oakland, where you represent. She's a prosecutor district attorney, in this area. I know you got static when you endorsed her from some progressives. Tell me a bit about the Harris you know. What should people who did not come of political age in the area that she did know about her?
Well, first, let me tell you, I am so excited and happy that Vice President Biden selected her as his running mate as vice president, because they're a great partnership. And she's someone who I know is prepared. She's smart. She connects with people. She knows the struggles of everyday folks. And she's a for real woman. She also brings forth a really good view of what progressive politics brings and why we need to have at least a minimum wage of $15 an hour, or address climate change, or address criminal justice reform and racial justice. Her experience has been phenomenal. And so for her to be in the Situation Room and in the Cabinet Room, I feel comfortable to know that she's going to be that voice that's going to fight to break down some of the structures in this country that are based on racism and economic inequality. She's a phenomenal woman. Yes, I was really proud to be, I think I was the first member of Congress to endorse Kamala when she ran for the presidency. And she was born in Oakland. She is a woman who, crosses it. You know, we talk about intersectionality, you know, South Asian, African American. She's a woman who has been the attorney general of the largest state in the country. She has management skills as well as a vision for where this country needs to go. And so I'm hoping that everyone will vote for the ticket. And as a progressive and as a former co-chair of the Progressive Caucus and former chair of the Black Caucus, I'm just saying that this is her moment, and this is the moment for us to begin to dismantle the old structures and systems in this country and move toward transformation. And I know that Kamala wants to do that as vice president. So I'm excited. I'm really happy. And we just have to do the work between now and November and make sure that the Trump regime is cleared out of that White House, because we can't afford another 4 years.
One other question on this. So something that's been striking to me is that there's been a lot of pushback on Harris from folks on the left, even though she is one of the two or three most liberal voting records in the Senate. You're somebody who's long been a hero to progressives. What do you think you see about her that some of them don't? Or why do you think there is this disconnect between the way sort of I think Harris views herself, the way the way her voting record looks, but also the discomfort a lot of people on the left have with her?
Well, I've been a progressive all my life. I co-chair the Progressive Caucus, chair the Congressional Black Caucus, work for the greatest progressive warrior who was the father of coalition politics, Ron Dellums, come from a progressive district, but I always have known and have fought the issue of race with the progressives. Sometimes race is not seen as a factor, a progressive factor. And so I'm not sure if it's an issue of not seeing a Black woman as being progressive enough, or what the issues are, because, you know, nobody's perfect. No one's 100%. But when you look at her voting record, when you look at what she stands for, when you look at how she relates to people and understands where this country needs to go for low-income people, poor people, the middle class, you know, she's a person who's going to take, who has and will take on these fights. So I'm not sure what this is. It's in many ways for me disappointing, but I'm going to keep working. I'm going to be working very hard to make sure they get elected, and I'm going to talk to progressives and try to understand at a deeper level what it is about this African-American woman that concerns them so deeply. And I'm sure, though, that they at least understand that she wants to protect our democracy, and that she will protect our democracy, and that she will prosecute the heck out of this administration during the campaign, and that with their help, she will win. And I'm just hoping we can unify with progressives and with the Biden-Harris ticket to win, and to win big, because, you know, I'm a staunch progressive, and I will always be a progressive, because the progressive agenda is an agenda that the entire country is embracing. And when you break down what progressive politics really means, when you're talking about $15 an hour, climate change, when you're talking about addressing, taking on the big banks, the oil companies, I mean, Kamala Harris has done all this. And so, you know, we've got to really understand what a progressive agenda means for the country. And I do believe that she reflects positions based on our progressive policies and progressive agenda.
I know we're running out of time here, so let me end by asking you the question we always used to end the show, which is, what are three books you've read that have influenced you that you would recommend to others?
Right now, Zelena Williams, The End of White Politics, please read that. Tiffany Woods, Say It Loud. And of course, Bryan Stevenson, Just Mercy. You know, I'm working on my Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Commission legislation, H.R. 100, and Reparations, H.R. 40. And, you know, we've got to get in context the historical context for systemic racism. And reading these books really lay out the issues from 401 years ago, from when the first enslaved people were brought to America's shores, and why you see, for example, and know that Black and brown men and women are killed disproportionately by police officers, the manifestation of systemic racism. And so I think these books kind of show that trajectory, that link from 401 years ago till today, when you look at the disproportionate rates of African Americans dying from COVID-19, for example. People don't make the connection to 401 years ago in the Middle Passage. So I think these books kind of set the tone for why systemic racism has got to be dismantled and disrupted. And so I would encourage everyone to read them. They're great books.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee, thank you very much.
Okay, nice talking with you, and thank you all.
Thank you to Congresswoman Lee for being here. Again, you can get more from this series at vox.com/the-great-rebuild. Thank you to the Omidyar Network for being our partners here. Thank you to Rojay Karma for awesome research on this episode, to Jeffrey Gill for producing and editing. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production.
This podcast was supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.